Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Robert Wright. Robert Wright is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, contributing editor at The New Republic, Time, and Slate. His first book was The Three Scientists and Their Gods, Looking for Meaning in the Age of Information. And he has also written The Moral Animal, a book on evolutionary psychology, and then more recently, Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, which charts the evolution of human consciousness from primordial ooze to Earth's custodian. Welcome, Robert Wright.
Hi.
Now, your most proximate book before Non-Zero was a book about evolutionary psychology. What's the connection between your interest in evolutionary psychology and then this theory of non-zero sumness? I understand that, for instance, there is this theory of the evolution of cooperation, which comes out of evolutionary psychology.
Well, yeah, non-zero sum logic can be applied both to the study of biological evolution and the study of cultural evolution, or human history, you might say. The basic idea behind a non-zero-sum interaction, to put it in slightly crude form, is that two or more people can come together and cooperate in a way that allows them to all benefit, so that there's no necessary loser in a non-zero-sum game. Whereas in a zero-sum game, there is a winner and a loser. I mean, their fates are inversely correlated. In a non-zero-sum game, the fates can be positively correlated so that the players can, in principle, they can all come out ahead or they can all come out behind. But you see that dynamic played out in everyday life, as it should be pretty obvious. People cooperate to mutual benefit sometimes. But also, it's a dynamic that played out in the genetic evolution of our species, so that that some of our cooperation results from genetically based instincts.
Now, there is a theory that human beings cooperate because of some kind of group selection effect. That our behavior is selected for at a social level, and other people are violently opposed to that idea and think that all selection effects should be individual-based. Is your theory in this book coming out in favor of a kind of group selection, a mimetic group selection effect?
Well, wait, these are two different questions. When you say mimetic, you're talking about the word meme, right?
Right.
And you're talking about cultural evolution. A meme is a unit of cultural information. It can be an idea, a technology, whatever. And the question, the issue of group selection versus individual selection arises even before you get into cultural evolution. Okay, the basic dispute among evolutionary psychologists over individual versus group selection is about, really, in most forms, in its kind of pristine form, the debate is about genetic evolution. Okay, so in one theory, in group selection theory, in kind of the extreme version, we evolve to be kind of indiscriminately altruistic, almost. We're nice to people in general because groups that consisted of people who were nice to each other in a diffuse way survived, whereas groups that weren't so diffusely altruistic tended to perish, or at least to not fare well. Okay, that's the group selection version of the evolution of the biological basis of altruism. The individual selectionist account of the biological evolution of altruism has more to do with interactions between two or among three or four people within a society, within a larger group, and doesn't deal so much with whole groups being kind of extinguished or whole groups thriving at the expense of others, large groups thriving at the expense of others. So this is kind of inside baseball, and is you know, and I'm not sure how many people will kind of grasp it immediately or care. But I wanted to stress that the debate you're talking about arises before you even get to cultural evolution. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, through cultural evolution, okay, that is to say the evolution, not the selective retention of genes, but the selective retention of ideas, technologies, whatever, you can certainly get cooperation in very, very large groups. Okay, so like, you know, whole nations are a product of cultural evolution, even though kind of nationalist feelings may draw on evolved impulses, but still, cooperative interaction of huge numbers of people is not a kind of direct outcome of biological evolution. That's something that happens through cultural evolution. Or a big corporation like IBM is a product of cultural evolution that may draw on biologically based.
Now, the theory of non-zero-sumness of some kinds of interactions, how similar is it to theories of, for instance, positive feedback loops in cybernetics or the win-win theory of trade in economics?
Well, the win-win theory of trade in economics is just another way of
talking
putting
about
non-zero-sum, you know, ideas. A positive feedback I'd put in another category. The two can be related in the sense that if you interact productively with someone, you get positive feedback for it, so you're more inclined to do it again. So positive feedback leads people to repeat the behaviors that led to successful cooperation. And so positive feedback is a really important part of the evolution of cooperation, whether you're talking about the genetic evolution of our cooperative instincts or the subsequent cultural evolution of kind of more elaborate forms of cooperation.
Now, given this positive feedback loop between cooperative behavior and the social complexity at an increasing growth of social organization, you've argued for an inherent dynamic tendency, which you see beginning in biology and continuing through cultural evolution, towards increasing complexity, increasing intelligence, and so on. And that idea is also controversial, as are a lot of ideas in evolutionary theory. I understand Stephen Jay Gould was very critical of the idea of an inherent teleological tendency, or perhaps non-teleological tendency, towards complexity. How do you respond to that critique, or is it just two different schools of thought? That you might be teleological somehow?
Well, there are, as you suggested in the way you phrased the question, there are actually two related but different issues. There's first the question of directionality. That is to say, did natural selection have a tendency to generate more and more complex forms of life, a natural tendency, and possibly more intelligent forms of life? So was it likely that you would get a species about as intelligent as us eventually through natural selection? That's the question of whether there's any kind of directionality in evolution. I believe that the answer is yes. Gould, although his position kind of changed over the years, more or less emphasized the no part of that, was more or less on the side of the negative answer. And I devote a chapter in Non-Zero to critiquing, I hope effectively, his view on that. So first of all, we differ on directionality. Now, some people who believe they see directionality in evolution are inclined to interpret that teleologically. In other words, to say that maybe it was the goal of, in some sense, it was a goal set up in the beginning that evolution would lead to higher intelligence. I am sympathetic to that. I'm sympathetic to only a particular form of that. I'm not sympathetic to the idea that there's some kind of mystical life force driving the process in some kind of immaterial way towards intelligence. But given my belief that just nuts and bolts, natural selection, strictly materialist account of evolution, given that I believe this kind of natural selection is likely to lead to higher intelligence, I can imagine a kind of deistic scenario in which natural selection was set up by something was set up kind of in order to lead to high intelligence. So in that scenario, there is some kind of larger purpose at work, and I talk about that a little in Non-Zero, too.
I'm speaking with Robert Wright. He's the author of Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny. And this is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. The argument that you then take the book through goes through the evolution of Western civilization, and you argue that non-zero-sumness can be seen in the consequences, the historical consequences of a lot of different things. One argument that you take up is why Europe became dominant over other cultures. You argue that that China was very close to taking off, but what was different about the European takeoff that kept and China did not make it past that threshold?
The question I address is, why did Europe get to the Industrial Revolution before China, which, say, 1,000 years ago might have seemed a more likely candidate to achieve any given threshold in technology? And first of all, let me say, this kind of emphasizes the nature of a directional argument. I'm not saying, in the case of cultural evolution, that it was likely that you could have predicted early on that Western civilization would have reached the Industrial Revolution first. I'm saying you could have. What was very likely from the beginning was that someone would reach an industrial revolution, so industrialization would happen. Similarly, in biological evolution, I'm not saying our particular lineage was from the beginning the one likely to get to high intelligence. I'm saying that one lineage or another was likely to get to high intelligence. Now, as to the question you ask, why one lineage instead of another? That's where contingency chance. Takes over, and in the case you ask about why Europe before China, as far as the Industrial Revolution goes, I think it has to do with the fact that China was a unified empire for so much of its history, whereas Western Europe, since the collapse of the Roman Empire, had so often been politically fragmented or politically decentralized. So you wound up. By the end of the Middle Ages, you wound up often having a system of kind of competing polities in Europe, competing with one another, competition just accelerates social change. So that good ideas, there was first of all an incentive for any given polity to come up with a good idea, whether economic ideas, you know, like the use of certain types of contracts or particular technologies, you know, a particular type of mill or something. There's competition to come up with the ideas, and as soon as one polity comes up with them, the other polities are inclined to copy them. There's a big incentive to use the best thing that's out there. Whereas in China, with one big polity, there isn't the same degree of internal competition.
But given your argument, isn't that kind of having your cake and eating it too? Because on the one hand, you're arguing that there are advantages to social complexity, higher levels of organization. On the other hand, you're arguing that Europe benefited from not having social complexity and higher levels of organization.
Well, there are, first of all, independent political units can be a kind of an overarching organizational scope to them. I mean, so for example, now you have independent nations, which are very competitive with one another. On the other hand, they are bound under certain principles of international law and certain institutions. Like a number of nations belong to the World Trade Organization, but they are still competitive. Okay, so the fact that you have independent polities doesn't mean that you can't realize the gains that come from a larger cooperative compass, okay? But at the same time, I think you're right to say that that at times there seem to be particular efficiencies gained by a single political organization. The Roman Empire is a commonly cited example. The Pax Romana allowed merchants to deal with one another across a very large geographic scope in a very easy way, protected, you know, without worrying about robbers and so on, and that's thought to have boosted prosperity. And I think it did, but the trouble with those kinds of setups, when large polities don't face a lot of competition, is that in the absence of competition, there's a tendency for corruption and stagnation to eventually set in. which seems to have happened with the Roman Empire. So I'd say to some extent, you know, the duality you point to, there's a kind of a pendulum swing where at one time the benefits of larger cooperation outweigh the downside that there's less competitive impetus within the area. But that lack of competitive impetus can eventually catch up to you. I think similarly, China at times benefited from the political unity, for sure. But in the longest run, that degree of unity and dominance is not as conducive to innovation as a more decentralized competitive system.
Since you brought up Pax Romana, one of the central arguments of your book, one which I'm very much in sympathy with, is the notion that there's an inherent logic towards global governance and the creation of global structures, governance structures of some kind. You say the loss of sovereignty is a fact of history. It's not some plot that's been cooked up by bureaucrats. But you wrote this book before the Bush administration had really instantiated its current Pax Americana vision. And I wonder if you think that Bush's Pax Americana is one form that this global governance is taking, or is it some kind of dialectical hiccup on the way towards it?
Well, you know, in principle, you can imagine global governance emerging from a single nation asserting its dominance and you know, imposing a kind of imperialism. I don't think that a productive form of global governance will emerge from the Bush approach, and I think in the long run, the Bush administration is pursuing policies that are not in America's interests, and largely because they really just don't get the picture. I mean, there are just a lot of things they don't see. They don't see, for example, the way information technology empowers very, very small groups of people and allows small groups of people with an intense political agenda to organize and commit terrorism and so on. I mean, they still have this idea that all important terrorism is state-sponsored, so you just go conquer states and then you control everything and you'll be safe. That's not even very true now, and it's going to be even less true in the future. So I would say, to the extent that my book Non-Zero was optimistic, and it's been cast that way, it's been called that by a lot of people, and there is some optimism in there, but to the extent that it was optimistic, it was the optimism was premised on the hope that political leadership in America and other places would be enlightened, and I'd say right now we don't have enlightened political leadership.
You're going back a second to what we were talking about with decentralization and centralization and the advantages of unity within cooperation. It would seem to be an argument for liberal democratic federalism, that you would have a political system, that the ideal political system would be one which allowed maximum cooperation and competition at the same time, some balance of the two. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's, in the logic of your argument, that there's some kind of end of history conclusion as well, that liberal democratic federalism, locally and internationally, is the ideal form of governance?
Well, I certainly think that as we approach world governance, if we do, we should seek a very decentralized form of world governance. In the past, as our earlier discussion suggested, states that opted for a very centralized approach and were very large, you know, large centralized empires, ultimately kind of fell apart because of external competition. They faced some threat from the outside that they couldn't respond to adequately. I mean, Rome and the barbarians, for example. But when you get to the global level of political organization, there is no external political competition, you know. So you worry a little more about a highly centralized form of government, being immune to challenge. I think we should worry about that a little, but I think we should seek the most decentralized form of kind of world governance possible. But the biggest threat I worry about is that we will maintain global order more or less, but at the expense of civil liberties. And I think every day the Bush administration pursues its policies, the prospects, the likelihood of that grim scenario kind of grows. Because ultimately, in the long run, I think given the way technology is going, the direction of technological evolution among a number of dimensions, I think, first of all, as we've said, we're going to need more and more in the way of kind of world governance, that is, institutionalized cooperation among nations to deal with threats such as terrorism. And secondly, if we're going to deal with a threat like terrorism without sacrificing a lot of civil liberties, we're going to have to reduce the amount of hatred in the world. I mean, because hatred is going to increasingly translate into massively lethal violence so efficiently that if there's a lot of hatred out there, the only way to stave off the threat is going to be to have basically a very authoritarian situation where people have very little privacy and relatively little liberty. So I think the big challenge is, you know, is attacking the motivation underlying terrorism. And if we don't do that, and I'm talking long term, I'm talking thinking 10, 20, 30 years out, because the threats will be graver then. If we don't do that successfully, then I worry about some kind of global police state being kind of, I mean, I don't want to get hyperbolic, but let's just say a relatively authoritarian state being the way people manage to keep terrorism to tolerable levels.
This is Change Server Radio. I'm Dr. J, and you're listening to an interview with Robert Wright, who writes for many different publications and is the author of Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny. Robert, as I'm sure you know, one of the problems with evolutionary accounts that some writers have fallen into is a functionalist trap that argues that everything that is served some kind of purpose for evolutionary history. And I'm not saying that you're guilty of that, but isn't it possible that some of the forms of higher-level organization that you point to could have gone in various directions, and that they, you know, that the interests and power of particular groups in a society are sometimes served better by those forms of power than other groups in that society? So in other words, with our global organization, we could have a more democratic global organization, or we could have, as you said, a police state, or we could have global organization according to corporate integration, which serves the interests of the very, very few. And the problem with a global organization is there's no competition. So I don't know. That's maybe not a question, but kind of where do we go with that?
I certainly agree that powerful people get their way more often than less powerful people. I don't have a naive view of the way policies come into being. A current example is American trade policy, where, you know, the American farm lobby keeps us from opening up our markets to less developed nations whose farmers, are close to starving to death and are not allowed to sell their food to us. So there are plenty of examples of powerful interests not serving the larger public interest. It's a problem. And it's kind of what, in theory, government should be there to deal with. There is, on the other hand, I mean, there is a kind of the current revolution in information technology, I do think, helps some previously underrepresented groups organize and have more of their influence felt. But, you know, there's no substitute for having a lot of money and power when it comes time to influence policy. So I think, at least broadly speaking, I agree with you. We might disagree if we started talking about what we think are the most egregious examples of this, but I certainly buy the basic principle.
At the end of your book, you get some speculative about some of the future historical possibilities that this trend towards greater complexity and intelligence might suggest, and you broach Teilhard de Chardin's idea of our evolution towards a new sphere and a mega point, and the ideas of a super social organism. It seems that I'm very involved in these kinds of futurological speculations, and there's the book Metaman by Greg Stock, where he also talks about how the global organism increasingly acts in an organismic way. What would be a sign of the creation of a global level of intelligence? Would it just be global governance, or would you want to see some kind of intentionality on the part of the global brain that would really be an indication that we'd moved on to a next level of evolutionary history?
Well, there might not be a distinct threshold. I mean, already, you know, corporations act purposefully and embody collective intelligence. You know, there's no one person who knows how to build a Boeing jet, you know. There's a corporation that embodies that knowledge, but there's no one who knows how to build it. And yet, you know, they take shape through a kind of coordinated social information processing system that collectively embodies the knowledge of how to build a jet. I mean, if you're asking the question of when would we know that consciousness had passed to kind of the social level or the kind of the network of people and computers embodied a superorganic consciousness, well, for all we know, you know, that's already happened. I mean, one thing about consciousness is that the only person who can be sure of its existence, or the only being that can be sure of the existence of consciousness, is the being in question, okay? I mean, strictly speaking, I don't know that you're conscious, and you don't know that I'm conscious. Certainly neither of us can say for sure whether or not the computer on my desk is conscious or IBM is collectively conscious. So just as a practical matter, the whole line between a bunch of organisms interacting on the one hand and a superorganism coming in, you know, existing, that's not necessarily a clear line to begin with, and some people would argue that we've already crossed it.
What are you working on now?
I'm writing a book on the history and future of religion.
Uh-huh. And is there a central organizing theme to that exploration?
Well, it's consistent with things I've emphasized earlier. You know, it's about cultural evolution, how religious ideas have evolved, and it ultimately deals with the concerns that I've exhibited, such as, you know, what's going to happen with the world? What, will we be able to hold it together, or will we descend into chaos? You know.
In your book, you adopt a kind of Durkheimian position that religion facilitates social cooperation and integration. It facilitates the non-zero-sum games.
It has often. I don't really consider myself a Durkheimian because, for one thing, I always have trouble understanding what he's talking about. But you're right. He was a functionalist in the sense of considering religion often a socially functional thing. And I think it is often a socially functional thing, even if I would differ with him on more specific things.
But certainly there are more functional versions. I mean, it's an unusual time to be writing about the functionality of religion when it may very well be the cause of not only our most recent two wars, but also future more cataclysmic wars.
Well, right, but this is a big question. As social organization passes from the level of the state to the level of the whole world, what role, if any, will religion play in either facilitating or retarding that? You know, most recently we've seen religion retarding it. At least those have been the most prominent stories. And but you know, is that the last word? You know, one thing I'm doing is looking at the history of religion to give us some insight into that.
Well, we look forward to that. And you can read more of Robert Wright's work at Slate and the New Republic and Time Magazine. And I have been talking with Robert Wright, visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author, most recently, of Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, which can be found many, many places online. And really want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.